I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the economy today. Europe's economy, the global economy, the American economy, as we follow the U.S. presidential campaigns here. We just wrapped up with Nobel Prize winner Joseph Stiglitz and his view of what's going on in Europe and globally right here in the U.S. I want to turn now to Douglas Holtz Aiken, economist, president of the American Action Forum conservative think tank. He was director of the Congressional Budget Office from 2003 to 5, chief economic policy advisor to John McCain's 2008 presidential campaign. Douglas Holtz Aiken joining us from Washington. Welcome back to On Point. It's good to have you again today.
Thanks, Tom.
We were supposed to be looking at a predicted, 2.6% GDP growth. Instead, it's been something like 1.2. How do you see what's happening?
Well, I would agree with Joe that we're really not seeing good economic performance. There's no doubt about it. It's been characteristic of the past 7 years. We've grown at an average of about 2%. And to put that in perspective, from the end of the World War II to 2007, the U.S. economy grew much more rapidly, about 3.2%. But the key is that it grew fast enough that even with population growth, the amount of income per person, GDP per capita, roughly a measure of the standard of living, doubled on average every 35 years. And so in one person's working lifetime, you could imagine achieving their version of the American dream at 2%, which is what we've done over the past 7 years, and what the CBO and other analysts project is the capability of the U.S. economy at this point, that doubling takes 75 years. And so I think of that as the American dream disappearing over the horizon, and the top priority should be to get that long-term growth rate up again and to have standards of living rise more rapidly.
And what about a 1% rate of growth?
I don't even want to think about it.
but that's almost where we are now, right?
No, it is where we are. No, I don't disagree. And, if you look at the U.S. economy in the moment, it's really a tale of two economies. We have a household sector that has actually done remarkably well. Growth in spending in the household sector is about 3%. It was even 4% recently. But the rest looks quite weak. The international sector is weak, a tribute to the global economy. The business spending has been dismal in this recovery. So it's really the Achilles heel of the recovery. We haven't had the sort of expansion of factories and equipment purchases that you typically get in a recovery. And those are things that are deeply concerning, I think, to everyone who looks at the U.S. economy.
And flat U.S. retail sales in July.
Yeah, not a good news story, because that's been the strong sector. And, you know, when I think about an economy that has sort of two different things going on in it, one story, the good news story, is firms look at the household sector, say, hey, they're spending, we will hire some people, we will expand, it'll be good, and you come together in a faster pace of growth. The bad news story is the household sector says, geez, this is not the time to be spending the money because there's not enough growth in our paychecks and in jobs and in incomes, so we'll scale back. And you really don't want that to happen.
Joe Stiglitz says, look, here's what's happened. Economic thinking has sort of raced away from political effects. And as a result, you've got corporations and the rich making out very well, but it's not bringing populations along. So aggregate demand is low and the whole thing just doesn't work. He says, you've got to think twice about just cutting loose, you know, the trusting the efficiency and stability of free unfettered markets, neoliberalism. You got to rethink it, says Joe Stiglitz. What do you say, Doug?
Well, Joe's made a great career out of pointing out flaws in the textbook model of economic markets and how Adam Smith got it wrong and markets aren't as good as Adam Smith said. But it always turns out that they're still better than the alternative. And so when he says rethink neoliberalism, the question becomes in favor of what? And there's never been a compelling alternative presented by him or others to how to make the U.S. and the global economy work better than our highly imperfect markets, which is what we have. So, I take it all with a grain of salt. I've been a colleague of Joe's for a long time and have watched his career. He's a spectacularly brilliant man, but he hasn't given us an alternative. So, what do we do? And if you look at the sort of politics and economics, I think he has a genuinely good point in that you need to have good policies become good politics. That's always the goal. It's not always very easy. And politics is characterized by fear and anger. Those are the most powerful human emotions. They drive people to the polls and to vote. But finger pointing and scapegoating is not typically good policy. So you have to provide an alternative to that kind of business.
Where do you see the economic visions of, let's say, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump pointing our national direction on economic health?
So I think the Clinton campaign represents basically giving up on changing that 2% growth. Her policies really have nothing in it for long-term growth. They are fundamentally built on the premise that we're going to redistribute. We're going to create lots of new entitlement programs, whether they're for pre-kindergarten education or for family leave or for child care or for minimizing out-of-pocket expenses in health, expansions of Social Security, increases in Medicare. You know, those are the heart of her campaign. And she's going to, quote, pay for them by taxing rich people, often in unspecified ways. And none of that's about economic growth. The Trump campaign is just muddled. It's hard to figure out exactly if there is a philosophy there. He's got promises to spend more in the military, spend tons on infrastructure, cut taxes by $10 trillion. It really just doesn't add up, and it won't cause the economy to grow.
I mean, Stiglitz says, well, he might say, fine, Doug, but we can't just go back into these trade deals, and so much of what's happened in recent decades has kind of wired things for multinational corporations and not for wider prosperity that makes the whole economy healthy. Are you talking about some kind of return to where we were? I don't know. You cite your best time. Sometime during the George W. Bush administration? Did we have it right then, really?
No, I would agree and disagree with Joe on some of the trade issues. Now, the one thing that everybody got wrong, the economics profession, the political profession, the world, was the impact of China and India's entry into the global trading system. We had over the post-war system a succession of trade agreements in the GATT rounds, the so-called mm-hmm. GATT rounds, the John Grumman tariffs, and then the WTO. They always were characterized by winners and losers, but the scale of the losses were never enough to sort of slow people's appetite for expanding trade agreements. China's entry, along with India, was an enormous impact on global wages. No question about it. And there were not provisions made in the U.S. and other domestic economies to help those people who were harmed by the impact. And I think that's a grave policy error. It's also in the past. There will be no other event of that type. There isn't another China out there to enter the global trading system. There's not another India. Those are the two most mm-hmm. populous countries. So there's a lot of refighting the last war going on and discussing trade. And
would you tear up NAFTA and reject TPP?
No. So here's the thing. Here's the thing that I think Joe has fundamentally wrong about NAFTA. He says, they have this clause where companies can sue, and if Canada had it to do it again, and Mexico had it to do it again, and we had it to do it again, we'd never
do that.
Yeah.
Guess
who all signed on to that in the TPP? The United States, yeah. Mexico, and Canada.
Yeah.
And so the notion that somehow NAFTA needs to be fixed, the way to fix it was the TPP. All were signatories, all had ways to say, no, I won't sign unless you do this or that. They all signed on again. So
why? Is that multinational corporation power speaking there? Why?
I think it's been less damaging than Joe asserts. And I for one, would say, if you don't like the TPP, you can read the entire thing. It's on the mm-hmm. on the website of the USTR. Tell your representative not to vote for it. My view of TPP is really quite simple. The United States does two things really well. It invents things. We have the most yep. inventive developed country, and we grow things. We have the most efficient agricultural sector. So if the TPP doesn't help us invent and sell and grow and sell, it's not in the American interest. And that's the economics of it. And then on the
and you think it does do those things? You think it does?
I think it does do those things. Not perfectly. Mm-hmm. You never get everything you want to trade agreement, mm-hmm. but I think it does those things on the whole. Mm-hmm. Has the first quote chapter on digital goods, for example, mm-hmm. things that we invented.
Mm-hmm.
And then it also, it's very important in positioning the U.S. versus China. And this is in the end all about China. In the post-war,
geostrategically,
the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and in the post-war was all about the Soviet Union and linking together Western countries in an alliance against the spread of communism. This is about China, which I view as a relentless foe of U.S. interests, someone who I far from view as a friend, and we want to make sure that we have allies in the Pacific Basin, and this is a way to do that.
Douglas Holtz-Aiken, please stand by. Lots of callers for you as well. Karen in Newton, Massachusetts, you're on with our economist. Thank you for calling, Karen.
Thank you for taking my call. I just want to throw into the mix here. it's really important when we're talking about the economy that we understand what we're measuring. And we currently are basing our numbers, I would say, in a finite planet, on extraction and commodification.
Mm.
So if we take a look at those measurements, they will come up short. If you take a look at, because we don't measure, as an example, we measure a forest based on timber feet. We don't measure it on flood mitigation.
Mm-hmm.
We measure economic activity in communities based on that extractive, commodifying economy. And I would argue that what's happening in vibrant communities around the world is not registering on the larger economic radar. When you, instead of putting another building on an empty lot,
yep,
stand together and put a community garden in, that changes their community. And I would say we need to start thinking of what people value as opposed to this economic numbers game that is increasingly isolating the very rich from the needs of all the rest of us. So I would be very happy to take a look at a system that starts discontenting those at the top and look at what people actually value in their lives. Because if you take things out of the waste stream and remake them and sell them in your community...
Karen, let me put it to Douglas. We've got it, and I'm very glad you called with it. Douglas, respond.
I'm going to agree and disagree. I mean, certainly... GDP or income is a measure of economic activity. It's not a measure of how well you are off. I mean, it's not in any way a welfare measure, and it's going to miss lots of things.
Including a lot of extraction damage. Environmental damage.
Sure. Oh, yeah. Or think of it, just, you know, we have a tornado or a hurricane or an earthquake. There's an enormous amount of damage, but in the rebuilding, we get a big boom in the economy, and that's not a good thing. We just destroyed homes and businesses and people's lives. So you can't equate the two and shouldn't equate the two. I'm going to agree with that. But one of the things that economists like about markets is it does reveal values. You find out how much someone values something by how much they're willing to pay for it. And that has proven to be a much better measure of value than what people say often, because looking what they do outperforms what they say.
But what about when a lot of the costs are hidden, not taken into account? Karen's suggesting, you know, you got downsides that just don't get factored in.
So that's why we have politics. And I view that as a good thing, right? If you're not going to be able to register your values through, you know, sort of commercial transactions, you have to register them somehow. Community activity at the local level, national politics are our ways to register what we believe to be important values, and in particular those where we're going to share them. We have to decide collectively what we're going to do. That's been the genius of the American system, to have both a private way to make decisions, I spend my money, and a collective way to make decisions, representative democracies.
Of course, Joe Stiglitz says that the economics have outstripped the politics here. Maybe there's some correction in the wind these days. Sophia in Detroit, thanks for calling. You're on with Douglas Holtz-Aiken. Thanks for calling, Sophia.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to... I've been collating the work of Fitchoff Bergman at the University of Michigan, Professor Emeritus, for some time. And going through the years of his thinking on these topics, I wake up every morning pondering, sometimes agonizing over these things. And what strikes me as apparent is that as an economy, and economists are not... I don't feel we're really talking about the shift from an industrialized society to a technological, automated society, and the hundreds of jobs that are inevitably going to be replaced by robots. That's the reality.
Hundreds of thousands of jobs, or maybe millions of jobs.
Hundreds of thousands, yes. Mm-hmm. And in these talks, it doesn't seem that there is a thought of how to repurpose the human being in this shift, because actually... that everyone needs a sense of purpose. We actualize ourselves through our work often.
Yeah.
And that's one question I have. And part of that, kind of tagging on to what Karen said, maybe with our high-tech materials at the moment, we can do a lot of self-providing in our localized communities. And maybe the idea is to have localized economies becoming more... self-producing, and therefore less reliant on the global trade.
Maybe that's why, Sophia. Our time is so short, but I'm very grateful for your call. Repurposing humans and the shift to automation. What are we going to do? How are we going to get paid? Make a living, Doug.
The truthful answer is no one knows. But the lesson of history is we have worried about this continuously for centuries, and it's never happened. It's never been the case that the tremendous advances in efficiency in farming, which released people into the industrial sector, the incredible increases in efficiency in manufacturing, which have kept manufacturing production high in the U.S., but employment's much lower. That's released people into the services sector, and it turns out people like lots of services. And so I'm sympathetic to the concern. If somehow miraculously, artificial intelligence and robots took over 90% of what we do right now, mm-hmm. I can't figure out exactly what we'd replace it with. But we've worried about this for a long time. It's never happened. And so I'm in the wait-and-see pose that says, well, if this turns out to be a real problem, we're smart people. We'll figure it out.
We just got 1 minute. What about the localism path? In a way, that's a version of... Sophia might not like this, but a version of Trump. He says, bring it all home, a fortress economy, we'll do it here, bring it right down to your community. Can we?
The reason we trade, whether we trade across communities, across states, across countries, is because we do some things well and other people do other things well, or have resources that we don't have. And we traded to get bananas because they didn't grow in the United mm-hmm. States. And that's the founding for trade. It's not trying to exploit people. I think Mr. Trump...
Though it has had that effect sometimes, certainly.
There are winners and losers in almost everything. But, Mr. Trump, if he went to Target and bought $150 worth of stuff, he'd view himself as having a trade deficit of $150. He got something back for that. That's what trade is about, giving up something and getting something back.
Douglas Holtz-Aiken, it's always terrific talking with you. I hope we can do it again as this campaign season rolls forward. Thank you so much for being with us today.
I greatly enjoyed it. Thank you.
Douglas Holtz-Aiken, president of the American Action Forum, conservative think tank, economist there, former chief economic policy advisor to John McCain's 2008 presidential campaign. And our thanks to Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz as well, who joined us earlier in this hour.